On a gray Seattle morning, and aren't they all?
No, there's summer. It's glorious.
A man in a perfectly unnecessary hat stands at the edge of the waterfront, gazing out towards the horizon. He's 78 years old, and he owns the restaurant behind him. And his view of Elliott Bay has been ruined by a line of boxcars that he cannot ignore. This is not the beginning of a political career. It's the beginning of a complaint. Months earlier, he'd responded the only way that felt appropriate, by filing paperwork to run for public office as a publicity gag.
Oh, a gag.
It was a joke, a protest, a stunt meant to end right there. Actually, running for office was not something that he had actually intended to do. When the realization that he was up Poop Creek without a paddle, he panicked. He pleaded with his own general manager to help him withdraw, but it was too late. He was officially committed. So he did nothing. He didn't campaign or give speeches. He didn't ask for a single vote. But on November 8th, 1983, Seattle elected him anyway, by 30,000 votes, to a six-year term on the Port Commission.
Wow, 6 years. You just accidentally committed yourself.
The man in the perfectly unnecessary hat had just become a government official, and Seattle was about to discover that voting for a joke still counts as voting.
History is messy.
Weird, wild, anything but boring.
We're Rainy Day Rabbit Holes.
Exploring the unhinged side of history, politics, and culture.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole. I mean, Seattle figured it out, but America didn't, so it's too late. Right.
So, Jody, if you accidentally get elected to public office with no intention of actually serving, what do you do?
I lead that bitch like a master.
Well, this person had a different idea.
Uh-oh.
Well, first thing, you just don't show up to meetings.
Oh. I mean, I guess if you didn't want to be there in the first place, you right. work hard towards being fired.
I mean, maybe you do one or two just to see what all the fuss is about.
Keep your paycheck.
Yeah. I mean, what even is a port commissioner? No idea.
Yeah, right. You just say that boat can come in and that boat can't.
Sure,
I don't know.
I guess. I don't know. Put that stuff there. And when your fellow councilmen finally get fed up with your lack of participation, you bribe them with clam chowder.
Okay. Homemade Ivers Skippers.
I mean, obviously, that's what you do, right? So have you figured out who we're talking about yet?
No.
Okay. Well, then let me read you some lyrics from the old settler song.
Okay.
No longer a slave of ambition, I laugh at the world and its shams, and I think of my happy condition, surrounded by acres of clams.
Oh, is this Ivor? Oh, this is crazy. Remember, we touched on his birth.
Well,
early on.
Hold that thought.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, the show where Pacific Northwest
I didn't even know he was a port commissioner. Now, oh, I can't wait to hear this story.
So welcome back to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes, the show where the Pacific Northwest keeps proving through history that it was always kind of unwell. Sorry, I was like, let me get through this slide.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking about the unnecessary hat now.
It was that captain's hat.
Yeah.
And of course, it does this in the most charming way possible. Today, we're talking about Ivor Hagland, the unofficial king or mayor of the Seattle waterfront. Most people in the Puget Sound know Ivor because of his iconic restaurant chain, Ivor's. Mm-hmm. But he was so much more than a simple restaurateur. He was, well, kind of amazing. A folk singer and a folk hero. A prankster, a civic mascot disguised as a man. He had a court jester vibe, but like the jester got the keys to the city and immediately went wild with seafood. Ivor is a perfect representation of the Seattle spirit.
Yeah.
He embodies three core Seattle traits, irreverence, community, and an absolute refusal to take himself too seriously.
Yeah, no conforming.
Nope. He was allergic to pomposity, mm-hmm. a little rumpled, self-aware. Exactly how Seattle likes its icons. Mm-hmm. He mocked authority, even while engaging with it. If he ran into a bureaucratic hurdle, he didn't fight it. He simply snuck around it. He might have been a showman with a predilection for the preposterous, but he was also one of the people. He believed that the Seattle waterfront belonged to everyone. And finally, the Puget Sound was his identity. His entire persona was wrapped around this place. Mm-hmm. Ivor Hagland wasn't just from the Pacific Northwest. He reflected the very best of it. Now, before we go any further, I want to thank historylink.org. Most of the information for this episode comes from their excellent work, and we'll be leaning on them heavily throughout this story.
I am so excited we're doing this story. I didn't know all these things
I
about
thought,
him.
Okay, look, I thought this story was going to be short. Mm-hmm. I thought this was going to be a 20-minute episode. Maybe we'd do it as a bonus episode. It wasn't going to take me long to write. I literally spent 7 hours Friday writing this story.
Wow.
Because I just got so into it. Like every new thing I learned about him, I was like, oh my God, I have to put this in story. Oh my God, I have to put this in story.
I just thought he had a restaurant chain and yeah. that his mom went to starvation.
Stop. Okay.
Do you remember what episode that was? Okay, you do? So we can tell people?
Zip it.
Okay.
Don't worry. Now, Jody, here's where things get interesting. Ivar actually has two connections to our past episodes.
Oh.
You already know about one of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which one?
Starvation Heights.
That's right.
With Linda Hazard.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Jody covered Linda Hazard in episode 28. Starvation Heights and Linda Hazard.
28? Feels like it was number two.
So long ago. Quack, doctor, or murderer. So Hazard killed at least 18 people, possibly as many as 30, with her so-called starvation cure. She preyed on wealthy victims, convincing them not only to starve themselves, but to endure hours-long enemas and to sign over their worldly possessions.
Crazy people always have an obsession with the butthole or sex or both. So crazy.
Keeping that butthole clean so you can sit on artillery shells.
Right. Yes, exactly. CR 5-Minute Friday.
Oh my God, that is the best story of the year by far. Amber Rawlings, my hero. Now, Ivar's family was forever changed by the starvation doctor.
Yeah.
Ivar's mother, Daisy Hansen, was sick, suffering from undiagnosed stomach cancer.
Oh.
Now, how she came across Linda Hazard is unknown.
Wait, hold on. She had undiagnosed. We know later that she...
Yeah, after an autopsy.
Oh, okay. Got it.
So we don't know how she came across Linda Hazard, but like you found out in your in your research that she would take out these full page magazine ads in magazines that were
displayed in prominent places. So these people that could afford to seek out Linda Hazard's treatment would see these ads about this amazing cure to everything, starvation, would go seek her out for treatment and pay these large amounts of money.
Yeah, I actually found one of her full-page ads.
Oh, did you?
That features her prominently in it, standing in it. And I'll put that on the website. But yeah, and they were aimed at wealthier audiences.
And women, specifically.
Yeah. Though we know she killed plenty of men, too.
Yeah, for sure.
Hazard convinced Daisy that starvation would cure her illness. For the next 50 days, Ivar's mother refused to eat. Friends and family pleaded with her, but eventually her body gave out. Daisy died on February 26, 1908, when Ivar was just 3 years old.
Wow. That's young to have stomach cancer. And maybe she was right in doing it that way because she could have suffered a lot longer.
Sure.
This might have been good
stomach cancer is no joke. Yeah. So an autopsy later revealed that she had stomach cancer.
We may have covered that in the story, but I can't remember.
Yeah. It was 28. It was so long ago. Like, I know that we've only done like 110 episodes formally, but there's been a lot of, it's been more like 300 episodes of different things. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's been 3 years.
It's hard to remember all the details.
It's been almost 3 years of us doing this, and I've only forgotten to hit record twice.
Yes, I agree. This is not pretty bad. Good. Your odds are good.
Luckily, we were ahead of the game, and it wasn't like we needed that episode right away.
Oh, hey, my God. And at least it was one we liked, so we could do
exactly.
It when we did it again.
And look, it was no like torture. I had never heard it before.
Yeah, no torture. And you guys, you should guess.
Yeah, which episode did we have to re-record?
That Shay knew the details to, but I pretended she didn't.
I actually, because of how busy I am right now and how my brain works, I kind of forgot all the details of it anyway. So
the one main point, and that is it.
Exactly. And even after his wife's death at the hands of a quack doctor, Ivar's father, Johan, came to Hazard's defense, expressing full confidence in her methods.
Yes, I remember this. Yes.
Yeah.
Insanity.
By the way, guys, one thing that was really cool, a couple years ago, we went to the Washington State Archives in Olympia, they showed us letters from Linda Hazard in jail, still promoting her starvation cure jail.
Go back and listen to the episode. She actually, at the end of her life, decides to use her own methods to help heal herself.
Yeah, if you haven't listened to that episode,
go
listen
out how it went, because it didn't, because I'm not going to reveal that. But
that was a really good
episode. But she still believed in it to the very end.
Which brings us to Ivor's father and the second link to one of your stories, Jody.
Oh, this one again.
You didn't know about, I don't think. Do you want to take any guess?
No. There's so many stories, it would be impossible.
In 1868, Johan Ivar Haglund from Sweden and Daisy Hansen Haglund from Norway purchased Alki Point from... come on, I'm just going to give you a moment.
Oh, why is... I can see his face.
It's recent. Somebody told us we got it all wrong.
Doc Maynard.
You got it! From that Doc Maynard. They bought Alki Point.
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
It's a small world we live in, Jay.
I know.
all of our friends and people we know.
Our friends like Doc Maynard.
Yeah.
Our buds.
All these people that we associate with.
We
in
feel
our minds.
Like we know them.
I know, right?
After Daisy's death, Johan raised... Am I saying Johan right?
I believe
I am,
so.
J-O-H-A-N. Yeah. I want to make sure I'm not butchering this terribly. That's, don't have to say it very
I
much
I worked
often,
with somebody
so.
that's how we said it.
Yeah. And he's from Sweden. He's mm-hmm. a Swede. Johan raised young Ivar with the help of Daisy's sister, Lorena, and her brother, Edmund. By all accounts, Lorena was kind and loving. Edmund taught the boy how to play guitar and tell stories. So it sounds like he had a really nice childhood after, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously after his mother died, that was terrible, but he was only three, so.
Right, right.
Lorena Smith and her husband ran the nearby Stockade Hotel, which, what a weird name for a hotel.
Yeah, that sounds inviting.
Yeah.
Would you like to make a reservation?
Unless it's the kind of hotel that, you know, stockades are fun. Okay, now the reason I say this, we've been invited to one of Rich's cousin's weddings in Philadelphia in September in Fishtown. And so I started looking for accommodations. And there was this one place, because you know on booking.com, sometimes people will put like their Airbnbs on there.
Yeah.
And it was really cheap. And I started looking pictures. So I was like, this place is cute. And then in one of the pictures is, I think it's called a St. Christopher's Cross. It's the big X that you are supposed to, that you can... chain somebody up to while you flog them. On the wall is a like inset box with all of these different floggers.
Oh, wow.
In the listing.
Options.
I was
Options.
Like, Rich, I mean, it's really cheap.
I've seen this before. I was looking for somewhere in Victoria and I'm like, is that, that's a sex swing. Like you included that in the picture. That's a legitimate sex swing.
I don't know. I kind of think even if you didn't avail yourself of the facilities, it would still be kind of just a fun, like,
of
to
course,
be like, this is
course.
The place we stayed in. Now, do you remember last episode I talked about every hotel room is covered in jizz?
Yes, yes.
Okay, anyways.
Wow, that would add another layer.
Moving on. Okay. So, so I was saying, Lorena Smith and her husband ran the nearby Stockade Hotel, built on the site of Alki's first cabin, the one originally constructed by David Denny and John Lowe. So the very first people, white people from the eastern United States to come over here and settle in the Pacific Northwest, David Denny and John Lowe. This is the very first cabin they built that I think it must be the one that they couldn't get like the roof right. And when their wives got here and saw that everything was leaking and nothing was happening, they cried.
Oh, everyone was leaking.
Yes.
Everyone was leaking, yeah.
Young Ivar mingled with guests there, entertaining them with songs and stories. He grew up immersed in history and the sparkle of a showman's life. Ivar loved music and dance. He performed in school shows and taught himself to tap dance. Eventually, he developed a full routine, songs, storytelling, and stand-up comedy all mixed together.
I'm picturing little tiny Ivar, and I'm thinking, wow, what an amazing group of adults around him that allowed him to explore.
Yeah.
You know, it was very much children are seen, not heard. Mm-hmm. You have to behave in certain ways. You're going to be, you know, you got to follow the theme of life, you know, what a boy does, what a girl
right.
does, all that. And he just got to do whatever felt right. It feels like he had some permissive parents in that era.
Well, and I think so, too.
Or parents.
This Stockade, well, I mean, yeah, but he was also raised by his aunt and uncle.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
They probably Adults. Were, mm-hmm. there was probably a little bit of, like, sympathy for the man, the boy who lost his mother.
Yeah.
To give him a little bit more permission. And then they're also busy running this hotel. So
right.
he's probably running around.
Just doing his own thing.
And there's pictures of all these guests on the grounds of this hotel, and they're all dressed up in their early 1900s garb, and they're all smiling. And like, how often do you see pictures from the early 1900s where people are smiling?
Yeah.
So it just seems
That's
like
true.
Through all of the hardship, he still had a wealthy family.
Like a joyful life.
But
it sounds like
it was joyful. Yeah. His sense of humor caught the attention of his first wife, Margaret. And thanks to a sizable inheritance from his late mother, along with rental properties passed down by his father, Ivor was able to devote himself fully to entertainment. So he was just living off the rental income from these properties in Elkhi.
Who knew? Like, this guy was just running around being free.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I just pictured somebody who came up hard in a hard life and, you know, persevered in the American dream, starting a restaurant that became something in Seattle. You know, well, I'm not picturing him as this cute little kid running around being weird.
Well, it sounds like he was able to fully develop
into
this
who he
passion,
was.
Yeah. Which, I mean, obviously at that time, that's very privileged, but it allowed him to turn into the person that he eventually did. And, you know, just shaped by, it sounds like he had love in his life.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and
despite
care.
Having no mom. He managed to have enough adults in his life that loved him and encouraged him.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. I'm sure, obviously, in the early 1900s, most people experienced some sort of hardship
loss,
and tragedy
because
it was still
very normal.
But it sounds like he had a pretty idyllic childhood, you know, despite having lost his mother.
To Linda Hazard and cancer.
Yeah.
She probably would have died anyway.
He became an expert in Northwest folk music, memorizing more than 200 songs. By the late 1930s, he was restless. He needed something new. One fateful weekend, he visited his cousins, Greta and George Smith, who owned an aquarium in Seaside, Oregon, which, by the way, still exists to this day.
It I was just wondering
Seaside
that.
Mm-hmm. Aquarium.
All right. Next time we're down there.
We got to go. And we'd be like, we knew Ivor.
Ivor's cousins.
Oh, yeah.
Own this. Did you know that?
When somebody tries to talk to us at a bar.
We're going to be such know-it-alls.
Oh my God, we're insufferable. We just got to find...
Already, I see that coming because we're...
Oh, like, I already
we go,
do that.
We go on these tours and we're like, oh, but did you also know?
We're terrible. That's why we have to do private tours only.
Did you? Yeah, oh, I heard this too. Oh, did you know during my research I found this? Yeah, we're those people.
He loved the idea of a sidewalk attraction. It seemed like an easy way to collect dimes during the Depression. And he had a plan. According to Ivor, all you had to do was, quote, pump the environment out of the harbor, circulate it around the tank, and back out again. All you have to do is feed the critters. Simple.
Right. Super easy. 1 hour a day.
Now, imagine you're a Chinook salmon. You're minding your own business, swimming around Elliott Bay, doing fish stuff. And suddenly you're sucked through a tube into a tank sitting on the edge of Pier 54. Well, back in the day, it was Pier 3.
Oh, wow.
With moon-faced humans pressing their noses against the glass. You panic. You swim in circles for hours. And just when you resign yourself to your fate, you're dumped unceremoniously back into the Puget Sound.
Oh my God.
You try to tell your salmon friends. They just think you've been eating weird kelp again. Anyway.
I was abducted by aliens. Right? They observed me through this big window.
So Ivor set up a stool in front of his little aquarium, which was just one room, and regaled passerbys with folksy ditties that he had written about the temporary residence of his tank. This became Seattle's very first aquarium. Three large fish tanks and a fourth for other sea creatures, with 5,000 gallons of Elliott Bay water circulating through every hour. And the star of the operation, besides Ivor, obviously, was Pat the Seal. Or rather, Pat the Seals, plural.
Yeah.
In 1939 alone, Ivor went through five Pats. The first swam off during a dip in the Sound because Ivor was just like, oh, you should go take a dip in the Sound. And it's like, F you, I'm out of here.
Right? He's a terrible kidnapper.
It's terrible. Well, yeah, because three others died.
Oh.
And finally came the fifth Pat, the keeper. The public adored Pat. During Christmas in 1940, Ivor dressed him in a frilly dress and a baby cap, placed him in a wicker carriage, and wheeled
him
through the Pike Place Market before heading to see Santa at Macy's.
Oh my gosh. He is a Seattle mascot, isn't he? I love him.
And here's the thing. Pat loved Ivor's music. Ivor would pull out his zither, which is kind of like a weird flat guitar, and start to strum. Pat would swim over, listen intently, and then bark his approval at the end of each song. This just would go on and on.
That's so cute. You know, my cats like it when I sing. I think it's weird, so I do it. And they, like, come over and stare at me.
What terrible noise you're making. Are you dying?
Okay. In my mind, they like it. Okay, Shay? They're not saying those things. In my mind, they're intrigued, and they want me to do more.
They're like, are you okay? Are you in pain?
No. They clap at the end, okay?
With their little paws?
Yeah. They do like during it, they're doing like air biscuits.
Are they?
No.
Oh, in your mind. That's cat people get weird. So the aquarium was also full of drama. It was cute when Ivor slung Marmaduke the octopus over his shoulders and strolled down Alaskan Way.
Oh,
but the octopuses Marmaduke. Themselves were getting into real trouble. Two of them hated each other.
Oh.
After being placed in the same tank, one sprayed ink at the other one, who promptly climbed out and slithered through the stunned crowd of the aquarium.
Oh my God. He's like, I'm out. I will not put up with this.
And then there were the not so cute stunts. Mm-hmm. Ivor decided that octopus wrestling would be a great draw. Not octopus versus octopus, human versus octopus. You did the in your weird sports. We talked about this down in Tacoma. Titlow Beach, where
Was
awful.
He part of that?
No.
No, okay.
Not that I can tell. I mean, maybe, but I
Something
didn't get into
similar,
it.
Huh?
Yeah. The Humane Society and the press were furious. And it was later revealed that the octopus being restrained from attacking the over-the-hill boxer two-ton Tony was already dead.
Oh, what?
So they were just puppeting his arms.
Oh, my God. Gross.
Yes, it's bad. The aquarium brought joy, except for that part, and education to many in the Puget Sound.
So you're going back, you said this is part of the, this is like the start of the current aquarium.
No, you didn't say that. This was just Seattle's first aquarium.
Oh, yeah, Seattle's first aquarium, not the first of this aquarium. Got you.
Okay. Yeah. No, this aquarium eventually went away, and then I don't know the provenance of the current Seattle aquarium, but yeah, this was the first one.
Okay.
So the aquarium brought joy and education to many in Puget Sound, except for the octopuses.
Right.
Along with more than a little chaos. And it sparked the most famous endeavor of Ivor Haglund's life. But first, Jody, let's go grab some clams.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Or
fried
dirty.
Or steamed.
Are we grabbing clams? Or
oh, yeah.
Grabbing
I must be hungry in that way.
Actually, that does sound really good. Some steamed clams and a little white wine butter sauce.
Yes.
Mm. With some nice sourdough bread. Let's go to Anthony's.
They have it right down at Al Lago. It's pretty good.
Mmm. All right, welcome back. When we left off, Ivor had just launched Seattle's very first aquarium. And when he opened it, he didn't do it alone. He backed a young friend from West Seattle, Roy Buckley, in opening a fish and chips stand right at the entrance to the aquarium.
Hmm.
You see where this is leading. Mm-hmm. It was, unfortunately...
Wait, so you go in and see the fish and then you come out and eat the fish?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically. Or you eat the fish before you go in. Or you're
Either
eating
way.
The fish while you're looking at
oh,
the fish.
Oh, could be, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was, unfortunately, too successful. A neighboring establishment, Steve's Restaurant, complained to the landlords of Pier 54 that the fish and chips stand was stealing their business. So within a year, the stand was gone.
What?
Yeah.
Hmm. Keep talking. I'm mad.
The aquarium itself closed in 1956, largely because Ivor had more time-consuming things on his mind. But the success of Buckley's Fish Shack had planted an idea, a restaurant.
So instead of a stand, we're going to go full bore.
Mm-hmm. So in July of 1946, Ivor opened Ivor's Acres of Clams on Pier 54. According to the Marine Digest on May 4th, 1946, the restaurant offered Puget Sound seafoods and many unusual pescatorial delicacies.
Pescatorial delicacies.
Acres of Clams could accommodate 100 people at tables and a counter and featured all electric equipment, including a cup warmer.
Yeah. A cup warmer?
Yeah, because according to Ivor, hot coffee is better in a warm cup.
Huh. Yes, it is.
I like this man even more.
Right?
Haglund was assisted in the enterprise by his father-in-law, H.M. Butler, who brought 20 years of experience in hotel dining rooms, restaurants, and resorts. In other words, someone who nearby who knew how to actually run a restaurant. Because right. Ivor didn't know how to do any of these
right,
things.
Right, right. No, he was just out being quirky.
Yeah.
The interior. That brought a lot of good ideas, but nothing to back it up with. This is perfect.
Yeah, and it sounds like sometimes, you know, like we see with the aquarium, he would get into an idea, run it for a while, and then kind of get bored and move on.
Kind of like me.
You and Ivor.
This is the longest running gig I've done.
Same, like the longest running hobby I've had.
Yeah.
And it's a hobby that's very expensive.
Yeah,
time
yeah, right. But here it is. We're still at it.
The interior was nautical in theme, of course. And as Ivor described it, a little shabby, but sincere, much like his aquarium. Acres of Clams was inspired by the folk song, Old Settler's Song, written by Francis D. Henry around 1874, and Ivor leaned into that history hard. He even used the tune as the theme song for his 15-minute Sunday radio show, Around the Sound with Ivor, So he's got a rhyme. So around the sound with Ivar Haglund. So is it sound and Haglund? How do we make that rhyme? Sound Haglund.
Haglund.
Haglund. And the marketing? Well, that was pure Ivar. Ivar loved punts. Good ones, bad ones, groan-inducing ones. It didn't matter. If there was a clam anywhere nearby, he was going to wordplay it to death. Cultured clam became clam culture. Acres of Clams proudly declared itself the place where clams and culture meet.
Oh, okay.
His chowder wasn't just chowder. It was ever-rejuvenating clam nectar. And husbands were warned they needed their wives' permission before exceeding 3 cups.
Because?
There is a commercial about this.
This is
with okay. Ivar saying that men, you can only consume 3 cups. Something about we don't want you to be crowned the king of clams because it's expensive.
Okay, so you're digging into the family's bank account if you keep on going.
I guess maybe they're saying like his clam chowder is like crack.
Got it. Got it.
So if you're going to empty the family's coffers on clam chowder, you need your wife's permission.
Sure.
This was food for thought, literally. Seafood is brain food, Ivar insisted. Be wiser at Ivar's.
Oh, my goodness.
All of it. Every sign, slogan, and menu line rolled up into what he called clam culture. A complete worldview built on seafood, puns, and cheerful nonsense.
Okay. How old is he at this point?
Because
I always see him like in his old man version with his fisherman garb on, right? He's out in the rainy sound. And so far, I've not heard him go out on the sound, really. Like, did he go? He doesn't go out and fish. He does things.
Oh, no, he would go fish.
Oh, would he? Okay.
Yeah, and dig clams and stuff like that. He loved that kind of stuff.
Okay, okay. So he was wearing
You know,
that.
I don't know if I even said when he was born. So he was 3 years old when his mom died in, let me look. I'm looking back here. 1908. So he was born in 1905, and he started the clam restaurant in 1946. So okay. He was just 41 years old when he started that. Now, all of these things he did, I bounced back and forth a little bit because I was literally following HistoryLink.org's timeline.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, it seems like he started the aquarium in the late 30s. Like I think it was 1938. So he was, you know, still fairly young. And then he reaches, you know, middle age and he starts the restaurant. And then as he got richer and more influential, he got more eccentric.
Got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
So like I was saying, everything was rolled up into his clam culture, a complete worldview built on seafood puns and cheerful nonsense. There was the Order of the Clam Medallion, the Clam Digger Room, which now admittedly reads a little differently.
Yeah, right? You find those in special
bars.
Yeah.
The Clam Gun, the Keep Clam.
Oh, yeah.
Which was both a motto and the name of his clam dredger. Keep clam and carry on.
Yep, I remember that.
Like no other restaurateur, Ivar wasn't just selling food. He was advertising a relationship. Ivar's loves customers. Customers love Ivar's.
Aww.
Other great Seattle restaurants reflected the personalities of their owners, too. But Ivar earned his place with homely sass, cornball wordplay, and an unshakable belief that a good pun was actually a civil service. When columnist Emmett Watson once followed Ivar through a work day and asked him what the secret was, Ivar didn't hesitate. Sometimes, he said, it was just sitting and thinking. Sometimes it was doing nothing instead of getting in there and lousing things up.
Lousing. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ivar didn't run his restaurants so much as he got out of their way and let clam culture do the rest. Sometimes, though, Ivar's love of puns and absurdity got him into trouble. In 1960, for instance, Ivar decided it would be cute to introduce his own postage stamp honoring the clam. He was inspired by U.S. Senator Margaret Chase Smith, who had once suggested honoring Maine's sardine with a stamp. So Ivar wired Washington Senators Warren G. Magnuson and Henry M. Jackson to lobby on behalf of the clam. He argued that the special stamp would raise money for a guided missile program.
Oh, wow.
It's like
straight to the heart.
Yeah. Very. He had a friend print several thousand official looking stamps. At the top were the words, keep clam, clam up. A large clam dominated the center. And we'll have pictures of this on the website. 4 cents, U.S. postage, 1960, printed at the bottom. Ivar began selling the stamps in his gift shop and proposed to the federal government that a ceremonial scuttling of the stamps in Elliott Bay, complete with a brass band playing Asleep in the Deep, and the U.S. Postal Service was not amused.
No?
They don't seem to jump on that. They confiscated the stamps and printing plates and destroyed them.
I see, yes, yes.
They destroyed them in the official basement postal incinerator, much to Ivor's delight.
Oh.
He thought it was hilarious that the U.S. Postal Service had an official basement incinerator for disposing of fraudulent stamps.
Fraudulent stamps. And that his were so good.
That they added.
His prototype was so good.
Yeah, he was like, yes, success.
That they had to destroy it.
Ivor's hijinks were far from over. But first, let's take a short break to earn some clams of our own.
Mmm, yum.
Welcome back. When we left off, Ivor was just getting started with the pranks. His next infamous battle would be permanently immortalized on the Seattle waterfront with a bronze statue. Businesses in seaside locations are rarely fond of seagulls. They harass customers, dig through the trash, and poop on everything with enthusiasm. So in 1971, Harbor Tours, one of Ivor's neighbors on the pier, put up a sign reading, "Don't feed seagulls, health regulation." Ivor was miffed. He explained, "I don't want to embarrass my neighbors. They do what they want on their pier, and I'll do what I want on mine. I consider seagulls the unpaid guardians of public health."
Oh.
"They keep the waterfront free of garbage. They are beautiful, useful scavengers."
Oh, they clean up our trash.
Yeah. To make his point, Ivor installed his own sign outside the restaurant. It said, "Seagulls welcome. Seagull lovers welcome to feed the seagulls in need."
Aww.
And he had to rhyme, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
He even published a recipe for seagull health bread.
Oh.
I don't know if it's healthy for the seagulls so you could feed them.
Oh, got you. That would make sense. Because I know it is bad for them.
To commemorate Ivor and his deep affection for gulls, a group of friends commissioned a bronze sculpture of him feeding French fries to the birds. It was placed in 1988 and still sits today outside Ivor's Fish Bar at Pier 54.
Oh, wow.
We gotta go there.
We gotta go there.
Now I want to go there. Oh, that's what we should do on our Seattle date is go down there and get a cup of clam chowder and say hi to Ivor.
And we'll take a picture. Absolutely. And we'll post it.
Are we, though? We rarely take pictures, and then we always forget to post them.
I was just showing my grandkids some other pictures. I'm like, oh, yeah, we took those pictures, and I never sent it to you.
Like, I never posted the pictures. I was like, I'm going to take this for the Instagram. Never post them.
The
I can't be bothered
underground
with social media.
Tour we did, private tour. I have some of you, and I'm like, oh, yeah, I forgot.
I know. We should do something with these at some point. Through all of this, if anybody wants to be our social media manager, for free, of course. We are happy to let you into our lives. We will send you all these pictures and you can do whatever you want with our social media.
We will release episodes one day early for you.
Personally. There are things we might do for you that we can't speak about on this podcast.
Wow. Wow.
So, I don't know what that is.
I don't know. We're on a clam episode. So any females out there, Shay's offering.
We're going to go to the clam digger together. Okay. Why me?
You offered.
Oh, that's true. Through all of this, Ivor's love of music never faded. From about 1940 on, his voice could be heard on the radio singing folk songs and shanties, many inspired by the creatures in his aquarium. He was friends with Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, who stayed with Ivor and his first wife Maggie in their West Seattle home. In the 1950s, Ivor became a regular on Como TV's award-winning children's program, playing first mate Salty alongside Don McCoon's Captain Puget.
Wow.
And one of Ivor's most iconic pranks happened on February 6th, 1947. A railroad tank car at Alaskan Way and Columbia Street ruptured, spilling thousands of gallons of corn syrup into the street.
Oh, wow. Sticky.
Yeah. Ivor, always ready to ham it up for the public, had his chef whip up a stack of pancakes. Plate in hand, wearing rubber boots, he waded straight into the lake of syrup. He squatted down, pulled out a ladle, and joyfully spooned corn syrup onto his pancakes, grinning like an absolute idiot.
Please tell me he did not eat them.
I don't know. The picture is just him like smiling like he's the happiest person in the world while pouring the syrup over these pancakes. The stunt earned him the nickname the Crown Prince of Corn.
Okay.
And fortunately for history.
Like he needed another one.
But unfortunately for history, the photographers and reporters were already on scene and they captured the moment forever.
Oh, wow. I wonder why they were on scene already. Oh, just for the spill. Yeah, he didn't call them. He didn't call the paparazzi.
He just knew they were out there. Yeah.
Oh, he took advantage of the paparazzi.
He took advantage of this, yes. Between all of his silly publicity stunts, like his famous clam eating contest, which raises the unanswered but important question of how much puking was there after.
Yeah.
Ivor was also doing something very serious. He was getting rich.
Oh, off his quirkiness.
Mm-hmm. For all the jokes, Ivor had a real instinct for business. By the mid-1960s, the folk singing aquarium guy had become wealthy enough to do something that made his unofficial title official. In 1965, Ivor Haglund bought Pier 54, like the entire pier.
Oh, he owned it. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And of course...
Wait, is that a thing that continues or does the city own the pier?
I'll have to look into it. We'll get into like what he did with his estate at the end.
Okay.
And so then I would have to track it back and see where
feels
that actually
like it'd be
went.
Weird to buy a pier. I don't know.
No.
In my mind.
Because then he's just a landlord.
Right. I just so for all some reason businesses... thought the port owned the piers.
Yeah, I guess they're privately owned.
Huh.
And of course, he announced this purchase like Ivor Haglund. In a full-page newspaper ad, he wrote, "For me to own a wharf would be a paradox. One dock is plenty." Paradox. A paradox. One dock's plenty. You don't need a pair of them. Oh my God. Besides, sometimes
pun
I'm a little
intended.
Slow on the uptake. Besides, it would take acres and acres of clams swing the deal. Then I said, what the heck? Be fearless or you'll be peerless.
Oh my God.
So now I'm a member of the Elliott Bay Peerage, a Dock Duke, the 54th in a line of peers.
Oh my goodness, a Doc Duke.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, it's ridiculous, and it's also a man publicly declaring that he now owned a piece of the Seattle waterfront and doing it entirely on his terms.
Yeah.
2 years later, when the Port of Seattle tried to buy Pier 54 for a proposed World Trade Center, Ivor refused. Not for leverage, not for profit, but for sentimental reasons. He loved his pier. It was where his whole strange empire had begun.
Yeah.
By then, Acres of Clams wasn't his only operation. He owned multiple restaurants, was expanding around the city, and was already imagining what else he could do with his growing fortune. And that's where things get really interesting. Because once Ivor Haglund had real money, he didn't stop being weird. He just got weirder with better funding.
Yeah.
He seems like a more purposeful
Forrest Gump to me. Like, he's just roaming around doing all these fun, weird things with no, like... clear direction or purpose, and then boom, he's rich. Like, how does this happen? Mm-hmm.
Ivor's restaurants were wildly successful. I mean, they're still all over Seattle.
Yeah, for sure. Very Seattle. I mean, it's a landmark. It's part of Seattle.
Absolutely.
Starbucks and
Ivor's. Yeah. And because he's Ivor, he wanted something even more outlandish than a regular terrestrial restaurant. He wanted a floating one. However, the Seattle City Council rejected his proposal for a floating fish bar on Lake Union, so he had architect John Adams design the Indian Longhouse on the north shore of the lake. So, late one night, he had a floating concrete barge towed across Lake Union and installed at Ivor's Salmon House as the outdoor dining deck.
Nice.
And it's still there today.
Wow. Okay, so it's down by that, so it's on the north shore.
Well, he didn't have it installed at the Indian Longhouse. He had it installed at Ivor's Salmon House, which I think is in Eastlake.
Okay.
But the reason that he built the Indian Longhouse is because he wanted a floating restaurant. So he was like, okay, I'm going to build this instead. And apparently that one was kind of a disaster at first because he actually did research indigenous people's culture to try to make this like an actual native longhouse.
Okay.
Where it was basically just like a big fire pit in the middle with salmon over it.
Yeah.
But when he first did it, they couldn't get the fuel to light correctly. So it just filled the entire building with smoke.
Oh,
and so the customers all had to rush out because they were just choking on smoke.
Yeah.
It was a little bit of a nightmare.
It could have been quite devastating.
But if you ever go to North Lake Union and you're driving by, you can smell.
Yeah.
The smoked salmon there and the cedar smoke. Oh my God, it smells so good.
Mm.
Now I'm starving.
I know. We keep talking about clams and salmon.
Let's go fork out
and
for a nice Ivor's dinner.
We are Northwesterners who love this food, so talking about it is making it worse.
I really love clam chowder.
I do too.
It's so comforting.
I mean, I work in a hospital, but their Friday clam chowder is really
good. Is it really good?
They had salmon chowder last week, and I didn't get there in time.
It was.
I went and opened the bin, and I was like, oh, it's all... dried crusty chowder at the bottom. Dang it, I missed it.
And since Ivor now had what we might politely call F you money. He didn't stop thumbing his nose at bureaucrats. He just upgraded to doing it from higher elevations.
Good for him.
On May 19th, 1976, Ivor bought the iconic Smith Tower.
Oh, wow. The whole building.
Did not know this.
No, I did not either.
For $1.8 million.
Oh, wow.
Which is roughly $103 million today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He had watched the building rise as a child.
Oh.
It was built in 1914. So he was a little kid.
I didn't realize it was that old. Yeah. Wow.
Smith Tower was once the tallest building west of the Mississippi River, standing 462 feet to the roof. For decades, it dominated the Seattle skyline, and it remains one of the city's most recognizable landmarks. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, Smith Tower has a flagpole at the very top, but it was rarely used. The winds up there were brutal. Tearing flags to shreds and replacing giant flags was expensive. But when Ivor bought the tower, he had a better idea.
He put a clam up there.
Smiling because it's like everything he does is so much fun. I love it. So he went down to Great Winds, a kite shop in Pioneer Square, and bought a 16-foot salmon windsock.
Oh, no. Yes. This is amazing.
Which he named the Rainbow Salmon. It didn't last long because those winds are fierce. But Ivor loved seeing a giant fish swimming above Seattle. So he replaced it and replaced it and replaced it. I guess they finally had cheaper ones printed in Japan and sent over so they could just keep replacing it because it was very expensive to buy a 16-foot salmon windsock.
That's an amazing idea, though, because he knew the wind was so it would look like it's swimming. Mm-hmm. That's hilarious.
The city did not love this.
Why? Bunch of stuffy old farts.
Once again, they turned into sand in Ivor's underpants. Seattle's buildings.
Crabs.
Seattle's building department informed Ivor that the salmon violated municipal code governing flags and banners. And this is where the story takes a turn, because instead of lawyers, Ivor responded with theater. Of course, it's Ivor. A fictional relative named Uncle Thorvald, a man of great courage and deeply questionable judgment, alerted the press to the city's outrageous attack on joy itself.
I agree. That is joy.
Uh-huh.
I was so joyful picturing that salmon swimming above
And we've got pictures of him placing the salmon up there.
And the city is an old fuddy-duddy that came in and said, no, that's not right.
I got to say, the city redeemed itself slightly in this story.
I will wait to judge.
Okay. The media jumped in. Ivor became a victim of the too serious state.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then somehow the entire dispute devolved into poetry. The city's own building director. Oh, I forgot. Somehow this didn't make it into my story. His last name was Petty.
Mm.
The building director. The city's own building director wrote to Ivor in verse, insisting the salmon be removed. Here's what he said.
That's so petty.
Since your kite is in violation, you must remove the illegal installation. Keep clam, as I am. Ivor refused.
He sent to Ivor, keep clam.
That is what I think his name was Adam Petty. It was either Andrew or Adam Petty. Sent the city's building director.
Used his
Mr.
own
Petty,
slogan.
That is what he sent to Ivor to say to remove it.
Oh.
Ivor refused. At the jam-packed public hearing that followed, the city surrendered, again in poetry. Oh, what the hell. Laws are made for mortal men. So, keep clam as I am, you ham.
Oh my gosh. So this just makes me feel better that we might survive because...
Even like a stuffy city bureaucrat was able to find a little bit of joy in enforcing city restrictions and codes.
To or with a man who's known for his quirkiness and be able to communicate in quirkiness.
Like, how could you be mad at this guy?
Yeah. I don't know. He said, take the salmon down. I'm mad.
And finally, how can you be mad at Ivor?
Oh,
you can't
no.
be mad
yeah,
at
no.
Ivor.
No.
And finally, the hearing examiner issued the official ruling. Also in rhyme, granting Ivor a variance and closing the matter forever. Here's what he said. The record is clear. The variance is granted. So Ivor, keep clam. not as clever.
Rhymey.
But
definitely
but
still including his slogan
keep
throughout
clam.
The whole proceedings.
By then, Ivor Haglund's public character was fully formed. Hijinks, puns, and spectacle and self-mockery. Always walking the line between law-breaking and law-bending. As one anonymous public official later put it, Ivor never really breaks the law, but then neither does he keep it.
Oh.
Ivor happily played the role of the dumb Swede all the way to the fish bank. A local reporter described him as the lovable walrus who parlayed a 10-cent aquarium into what is probably the most successful restaurant operation in town.
That is, it's just, wow.
In 1956, R.H. Calkins, a columnist for the Marine Digest, concluded that Ivor was the waterfront's greatest showman in all of its history.
Hmm.
Ivor's legacy lives on, not just in the iconic restaurant chain that still bears his name, but in the cornball communal traditions that followed him long after he was gone. Things like dances with clams, chariots of clams,
and
the rapping fisherman. Yes. Do you remember the rapping fisherman?
Yes. I remember these are all commercials. These super funny commercials.
They're so, the commercials were the best.
Yeah. I didn't relate them to Ivor, though. I related them to now a business model. Ivor, to me, when I was, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, paying any attention, you know, just looking at his likeness is very, you know, grouchy, old, isolated fisherman, goes out, gets a fish, brings it in, gives the restaurant, makes it for us, he's out. You know what I mean? Not this quirky, fun guy that was like, had this whole other personality.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like he was so
much
fun. Why
did I think he was
a
curmudgeon?
I don't know. Perhaps most perfectly, do you remember this? The underwater billboard scandal, better known as Underwatergate. Okay, let's talk about this briefly because it does matter. In the summer of 2009, a series of YouTube videos appeared showing Puget Sound divers making a startling discovery. Barnacle-encrusted 1950s-era billboards advertising Ivor's restaurant on the seafloor.
Yes, I remember this.
The signs looked old, authentically old. Mm-hmm. And these videos were very professionally made. Mm-hmm. They looked real. They seemed, and we'll link to all this on the website. They seemed to suggest that decades earlier, Ivor had sunk billboards offshore in some grand prophetic publicity stunt, one meant to be rediscovered years later. Seattle lost its collective mind. News outlets scrambled, historians weighed in. People asked the only question that really mattered. Did Ivor actually do this? And the answer was no. The billboards were a hoax, an elaborate, lovingly executed piece of performance art dreamed up by Ivor's successors and collaborators as a tribute to his spirit.
Yeah, that even matches, doesn't it?
The guy who was writing a biography about Ivor...
believed it?
No, he actually was part of the hoax.
Oh, got
people
it.
Contacted him and he's like, oh yeah, totally true. So people were mad at him later.
Yeah, that's a lie.
For perpetuating this hoax, but he was just part of the joke.
Uh-huh.
If you look at it, this was just a big joke. And if you know Ivor and his spirit. Like,
yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when the truth came out, most Seattleites weren't angry. They were delighted. Because the most important thing wasn't whether Ivor had done it. It was that everyone believed that he could have. Yeah, yes, yeah. Ivor could have sunk billboards.
He was
the
that
Puget
kind of
Sound.
Guy. So they thought he had sunk them so that later we would find him as a publicity. He wasn't advertising to the fish.
No, I think it was.
To divers,
they
scuba
were
divers.
They were trying to suggest that Ivor thought that we would have underwater restaurants
at
some point.
Oh, got it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The hoax captured something essential about Ivor Haglund. The sense that even after death, he might still be pulling one over on the city. Mm-hmm. That maybe he'd planned it all along. That wherever he was... he was laughing right along with us and probably composing a new little song about it.
A rhyme, at least.
Ivor's final personal spectacle came earlier. In 1983, as we talked about at the top of the episode, he accidentally got himself elected to a six-year term on the Seattle Port Commission. He gave his final interview in the spring of...
what year?
That was in 1983.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh.
He gave his final interview in the spring of 1984 to a reporter from his old high school, West Seattle High. When the young reporter asked if there was anything left he still wanted to accomplish, Ivor didn't hesitate. He said he hoped to see a few more 4th of Julys.
Hmm.
That mattered because Ivor had created the Seattle's annual 4th of July fireworks show on Elliott Bay back in 1965.
Wow.
In true Ivor fashion, he kicked it off early at midnight on July 3rd. He was my neighbors down the hill.
Yeah, right. And it continued on for 2 full weeks.
Because he wanted to dedicate the restaurant's brand new industrial strength dishwashing machine.
Oh, wow. Yes.
With fireworks.
Right.
After the fireworks, he led his restaurant guests through the captain's table kitchen so they could admire the spotless glasses.
Oh, my goodness.
Ivor Haglund died on January 30th, 1985, at the age of 79. Mm-hmm. So he died of a heart attack while he was getting out of bed. In his will, he left personal gifts to friends, divided his estate between Washington State University's restaurant program and the University of Washington's School of Business, which is where he graduated from, and made sure, this is great, he made sure his former employees had the opportunity to buy back the business. And I think they did. But his real inheritance wasn't money or buildings or even restaurants. It was permission. Permission for Seattle to be a little silly.
We're weird.
Yeah, we are weird.
I was thinking that as you're telling the story, I'm like, how classic. This is so Seattle.
Yep.
We are just full, I mean, full of weird people all the way from the beginning.
Yep. To needle authority, to treat joy as a public good, mm-hmm. to believe that history doesn't have to be solemn to be meaningful. See, this is where I feel like I'm going to cry a little bit. Okay, get it together, Shay. There's been a lot of episodes where I cried lately.
Right, it's because of the animal stories. This is, well, I mean, there's clams, salmon.
Okay, and if you stand on the waterfront today, watching the gulls, smelling the chowder, maybe spotting a salmon where it absolutely does not belong, it's hard not to feel like Ivor is still there, hat on, grinning, perfectly unnecessary as ever.
I love it. I will definitely be looking at Ivor's restaurants differently. I have always seen them, you know, kind of like a Starbucks. They're a mainstay.
Northwest chain, blah, blah, blah.
I never saw him as such an endearing and involved character in mm-hmm. all of this.
Yeah, after reading all of these stories about him, I was like, this guy is Seattle.
Yeah, that's
or
exactly
the Puget Sound. Like, I wouldn't even say, like, just Seattle. Obviously, that's where he was based, but he's just the Puget Sound. Yeah. Like we mm-hmm. have along the Puget Sound, we have so many areas that are just really individual and quirky.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's a story behind them.
Yeah.
With some person, maybe not as big or famous as Ivor, but someone behind all these areas that did something out of the ordinary.
And it all always comes back to the Puget Sound, right? Mm-hmm. Always mm-hmm. back to the water and the sustenance that we get from it and the mm-hmm, sustenance mm-hmm. that people have gotten from the Puget Sound for thousands upon thousands of years. Like yeah, everything revolves yeah. around that. And he is just the embodiment of that spirit in like a joyful way.
I agree.
So
I agree.
I'm like, Ivor is now my new favorite person. If anybody knows anything terrible about him, do not tell me. I don't want to be ruined. He is dead. We don't need to
right, we don't have to
now.
Meet our hero and have it ruined.
That's right. So he is a human being. He is flawed and hopefully he did not do anything that is so bad that
crosses
we can't
your lines.
Like him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If he was a little the octopus thing was a little disturbing, but
it was dead, so it's fine.
God. His aquarium apparently did kill a lot of sea creatures, but they also don't like it when you take them out of their habitat.
Right. So, you know, he had...
I'm not a fan of aquariums because of this, but he helped
teach the future aquariums how to better treat their...
I hope so. You know, and he was very, I did not know that he was so involved in the Seattle folk music scene. Like he was a big part of it. Like he was considered an expert in Northwest folk music.
Yeah.
So like you recognize Woody Guthrie's name.
Yeah.
Who Woody Guthrie created all of these iconic folk songs. And in mm-hmm. fact, I think Washington State's official song is a Woody Guthrie song.
Oh.
We mentioned it when we talked about the... Grand Coulee Dam, because Woody Guthrie wrote a song about the Grand Coulee Dam.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he's so involved in the Seattle waterfront. Like you can't go down there and not see the legacy of Ivor.
Right. So, him as a person, where mm-hmm. I had always tied it to this legacy of this business and a caricature of a man.
No, he was the caricature.
Right. But no person behind it, though.
Like, oh, yeah.
You know, I just related it to this picture of mm-hmm. this person and a business, but not really like a whole human being with so many different passions and abilities. He was very much more interesting than I had thought.
Yeah, he was amazing.
Great story, Shay.
I hope that all of my friends here in the Pacific Northwest, I was thinking a lot about Pam Beal. I have a feeling she's going to love this story.
Oh, yeah. Hey,
she loved your JP Patch's story. Yeah, so I bet you she's going to love this. So hi, Pam. And I and Letha probably will love this one, too. I have a feeling she likes this one, too.
Maybe she'll meet us for some clam chowder.
Oh, there you go. Let's go get some clam chowder.
Maybe we can go find that.
Do they have a restaurant in West Seattle? They've got to have one in Alki. I mean, he's from Alki. They owned Alki. All right, we got to look it up. Anyways, all right, guys. Well, if you are in the Seattle area, make sure you go to an Ivers restaurant. Now you'll know it's not just another seafood restaurant chain. It actually is a piece of Seattle history. All right, guys, thank you so much. Stay curious, and we'll see you next time. You've been listening to Rainy Day Rabbit Holes. We thought maybe you had forgotten. How could you forget? We are your hosts, Shay.
And Jody.
And you can find all things on our website, rainydayrabbitholes.com, like sources, notes, pictures, links, whatnot. That beautiful website is designed and managed by the amazing and talented Letha Davis at easybreezy.com. That's easybreezy, EASYBRZY.com. All episodes are edited and produced by me, Shay, and you can reach out with any questions or comments at shay@rainydayrabbitholes.com. That's S-H-E-A. Thanks for listening. Please share the podcast with your friends and family, and stay curious.
See you down the rabbit hole.
Tired of sugar-coated news and corporate spin? Check out The Nicole Sandler Show, speaking truth to power with the irreverence it deserves. Smart, fearless, and just the right amount of snark. Nicole breaks down the headlines, exposes the hypocrisy, and talks with the people working for real change. Weekdays at 3 Eastern, noon Pacific on Progressive Voices, NicoleSandler.com, Substack, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't just get the news, get the truth.